Illumina News Center. Q&A. Courtney Felly, champion of youth living with rare disease. During Rare Disease Week 2024, we spoke with an advocacy leader on issues such as access to care and what policymakers need to hear. Published March 11, 2024. Young Adult Rare Representatives, or YARR, is a program that empowers rare disease patients in the United States, ages 16 to 30, to advocate for healthcare and policy reform. Courtney Felly, age 24, serves as the YARR program manager. She says, "I think there's something really special about having a young adult with a rare disease managing a program for young adults with rare diseases." She assumed this responsibility in 2021. She supports YARR members in myriad ways, performing outreach, matching members to speaking engagements, and connecting them to opportunities in the community. At every instance, she seeks to break down difficult policy issues, as well as ensure that young adult feedback is included in policy creation and advocacy. YARR's umbrella organization is the Every Life Foundation for Rare Diseases, now celebrating its 15th year and making an impact in Washington, D.C. during Rare Disease Week 2024. We spoke with Felly to learn more about Every Life and YARR activities, the current state of healthcare in the U.S., and living with a rare disease. The print article on Illumina News Center was adapted from the original interview you're about to hear, conducted by Aaron Glennie, Illumina's Senior Manager of Marketing Communications. Both versions have been lightly trimmed and edited for brevity and clarity, though the print version reflects the most accurate and up-to-date information.
Why don't you tell us about Every Life and YARR and how you got involved with them?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Every Life Foundation for Rare Diseases, my best way of describing this is we essentially have two arms. We have our arm that does public policy work on both the federal and the state levels in the United States. And that would be anything in regards to the development of or access to treatments for rare diseases, and then anything adjacent that rare disease patients are bringing up as a concern. And then on the other side, in that advocacy arm, you have programs that are designed directly to get advocates talking to their legislators, to have them represented directly. We like to say we don't speak for patients, we get patients in the door.
So how do you identify the opportunities or prioritize certain policies over others? I mean, how do you, I wouldn't even know where to begin.
Yeah, there's a few elements to this. Within the Every Life policy arm, we have something called our Community Congress. That's essentially our working group of any stakeholders in the rare disease community in the United States. And that is a mix of patient organizations, something like the VHL Alliance or Parent Project Muscular Dystrophy, and then a mix of industry members, folks like payers or research groups. And we have quarterly meetings where they come together. In those meetings, we do a lot of conversation about like the upcoming bills that folks are working on, the upcoming priorities that they don't feel like there are good bills out there and yet, like what are all the issues and gaps that different organizations are seeing? How can we all talk about those issues together so that every group isn't introducing their own legislation on a similar issue? We can like band together to have the solidarity of all addressing the much larger rare problem.
Could you maybe give an example or two of a bill or something that you supported?
Yeah. So the Safe Step Act, what it actually would do in the United States is help set up like reform and exception pathways to something called step therapy. This is something that I think a lot of rare advocates know, but don't necessarily know by this name, because it's essentially when an insurance company says, we're not going to cover the medication that your doctor just prescribed because you actually need to try medication A or medication B or medication C before you can take this actual appropriate medication. I've had this happen to me personally, too. It is frustrating when you and your provider both know you need to take a specific med. And this is an act that would affect people with chronic illnesses that aren't just rare, but it tends to hit rare patients particularly hard because there often aren't as well-established standards of care. Insurance companies often aren't as familiar with that condition or with other patients who've taken different medications. So this would create exception pathways for folks to be able to get onto the medication they need to take sooner and not have to spend all the time and money and potential disease progression.
So why are youth powerful advocates? Like, what does Gen Z bring specifically? I think it's Gen Z, right?
I feel like most, Yara is 16 to 30, so I feel like most people would fall into Gen Z. And I always say, like, young adult rare disease advocates aren't just the future generation. They are, like, the generation right now that is experiencing what it's like to be a young adult with a rare disease. Like, they have that direct day-to-day lived expertise. They talk amongst each other. Like, they know what some of those shared issues are. They know what some of the shared potential solutions are. But they are, as a group, often left out of policy discussions. Yeah, that is very much my take, is that young adults know what it's like to be a young adult with rare disease. And so they need to be able to translate that to policymakers who are trying to make policies for young adults with rare diseases. Because otherwise, there's just going to be that fundamental knowledge gap that does not actually hit the true needs of that population. My good example, too, is, like, in the United States, you have, like, the specific transition from pediatric to adult healthcare that happens both as you switch from seeing pediatric to adult providers and also as you switch often to your own insurance off your parents. Or like if you're transitioning from like a pediatric Medicaid program or CHIP to like an adult insurance program, whether private or public. And some of those drop-off points along that transition are really rough.
I think I read that your, I don't know how you say HEDS. How do you say?
It took me a while to learn how to pronounce because I think it's like Swiss. I should definitely know that. But it's hypermobile Ehlers-Danlos syndrome.
Did you have whole genome sequencing done?
I haven't yet, although I'm actually currently going through it. My sort of TLDR of my diagnostic experience is that doctors were very dismissive at first of like what symptoms I was experiencing. When I was in college, I was receiving accommodations and I was trying to like find a scientific way to say like wiggly wrist to be like, I need my laptop in classes because I didn't just want to be like my wrist wiggle. That sounds ridiculous. And I came across all of these like EDS forums. A few months after that, my neurologist actually brought up EDS to me. And it was like that diagnosis was incredibly helpful to know like what I actually should be doing, what I shouldn't be doing. The problem right now, so EDS has like 13 subtypes. And 12 of those subtypes have genes identified. The one that does not is hypermobile EDS, which is the most common. And there's a whole bunch of debate in the community about that. There's different like possible candidate genes. There's different research happening. Like there's motion there, but it's complicated. But it's funny that I feel like diagnosis is not one discrete moment in my life. It's like all these different moments and the ways things shape over time.
So yeah, we're sort of getting into, I mean, care gaps, diagnostic gaps, and we've also talked about, you know, the insurance issues and the drop-off points, because I really want to illustrate like some gaps.
Yeah, but there's definitely some different elements of this. I think a big one that a lot of folks don't realize from outside of the rare community is how few rare diseases really have treatments that are appropriately approved for them. Somewhere around 95% of rare diseases like do not have an FDA approved treatment. So you have a lot of like off-label medication use if and when there are medications that are appropriate to use off-label. So that could be really rough. I think it's hard because even when you do have doctors who are trying their best, there's sometimes only so much they can do. Like they hit the limit of where medical knowledge is. And then part of what's also difficult within the United States is the like federalized system of like how you can see doctors across state lines or how you can see doctors like according to your insurance provider. You sort of try to solve one problem and then you realize where all the other gaps are and like there's the whole ecosystem at play. And it's sometimes a challenge, but we all do it together. There are a lot of advocates out there for a reason.
So, okay, you've written about visibility and how I loved this and how the world doesn't often let you be both public and safe.
Yeah, I use various mobility aids. The way that each EDS affects my joints has now like moved to my hips and knees. So sometimes I use a cane, sometimes I use forearm crutches, and I have like a travel power wheelchair. It's like a bright mint green. I call her Pepper because she is both peppermint and she like gives me extra energy or pep. People don't necessarily expect when they're able-bodied and like don't need to think about using a wheelchair. I don't know a lot of wheelchair users. But it also means that I am very visible as someone with a rare disease or disability. So I can do something like go to Rare Disease Week and like get up and like give a presentation to the ER members or go speak to my legislator directly and like feel like I'm creating this really positive impact. And then I still go to like take the metro home and the subway is broken and someone says something kind of weird about like, oh, you're so young to be using a wheelchair. And it's like those have to coexist on the same day. And so it feels really strange sometimes to be like, I wish and I could just like move through the world and like not have to deal with a lot of this. But also because I do, I want to talk about it. I want to advocate about it. I want to be public about it. And I also want other people to know that there is a community for them to come into. There are people who are thinking about these things and who want to hear what they have to say.
That was great. That was so well put. So, you've kind of answered it. Like, what are a few things about rare conditions and disability that most people don't understand? You kind of did, but if there's more you want to tell us, like, school me, you know.
The average time to diagnosis from a study that we did is 6.3 years for rare disease patients across, it's like 300 something rare diseases that were included in that study. And the amount of specialists you see is 16.9 throughout those years.
Was that in the US or was that globally?
Yeah, this was in the United States. I talked to people at Rare Disease Weeks who went 20, 30, 40 years without a proper diagnosis for something that they've had their whole lives or close to their whole lives. And I think people don't understand often from the outside that feeling of like knowing something is wrong, but not knowing what. And like not necessarily having doctors have the knowledge or the tools or sometimes the inclination to figure out what's wrong. That is something that we do a lot with because we understand that the diagnostic odyssey exists. But I think folks tend to not realize. They sort of think you go to the doctor, you show symptoms, you get a quick diagnosis. And then there's like, even if it's not a perfect treatment for you, there's like something that you take. But often it's way more complicated than that. The journey is like so many twisting roads, so many loops backwards. It's not clear cut.
So 16.9 specialists. Holy moly.
It is a lot of specialists to myth out. Yeah. And I definitely had a lot of folks myth out. Not 16.9, but like I had like neurologists, cardiologists, like a bunch of folks like miss out on like what the symptoms were that I was actually experiencing.
That's crazy. And it's so much time. It's time out of school, time driving there. Oh my gosh.
Exactly. And like as a kid, like, it's like time my mom had to take away from work to drive me and like a lot of money for co-payments. And it was also, we did this in the study, but there's essentially absenteeism, which is like the obvious part. But there's also something that it's not our term, but we call it in the study presenteeism, which is essentially like when you're technically at work or technically at school, but you're so distracted by your symptoms or by the diagnostic journey that you're not really fully present or fully productive. Like, what is that also lost? There were definitely a lot of times where like, I was not able to commit like the amount of time I wanted to some sort of school project or to like a school club or other like social things that kids are supposed to do because I was preoccupied with trying to figure out like how to deal with what I had that I also didn't know what I had. Yeah, it's really, really expensive. The cost in the States alone from that study is it's just under $1 trillion a year. So we did all of the like national economic burden of rare disease study. And then we did more recently one on I think the technical name is the cost of delayed diagnosis. And it uses the same data from the original economic burden study. And then it uses like available commercial data. We worked with a health economics team on this and like the methodology is public on this. But it's essentially about that added cost of like what happens when you do not properly diagnose a condition at the time that it onsets. So we used a lot of examples from newborn screening in the United States because there's a really clear pathway of what happens when you are actually identified as a newborn versus later in life. And it is wild. The avoidable costs per patient with delayed diagnosis are over $500,000. They are $517,000 per patient. Yeah, it is absolutely wild. Some of that data, just like every time I look at it, I just feel empowered that we created it, but also just deeply sad.
I know. It's incredible to hear you talk because I don't hear any like bitterness. I feel like that's
so kind because I feel like I am so bitter. I remember when I interviewed for Every Life and they were like, what motivates you? Like, what wakes you up? And I was like, listen, I'm so angry. I've just decided that I can't be like eaten alive by anger. I have to make it like productive. And so I was like, yeah, I very much am like productive anger in service of love. You have to believe that there's like some possible outcome. And like, I have seen like bills pass or like changes get made or like regulations get implemented that are genuinely helpful. Like I have seen people make really big strides or really big successes that like help, even if it's just like it helped three people get access to treatment they otherwise wouldn't have. Like someone is alive because of the advocacy you did. And that is a big deal. Like those wins are important to remember because it is absolutely better than nothing. and you just work on it. You all work in it together. I like to think of it as a big tapestry where you're all just like, I'm a crocheter, I'm a knitter. So it's the fiber, it's girly. But I think about it as like, you're all working on one part of the tapestry. You're all weaving one part of it, but it's still that bigger picture that's in motion. It's just, no one can do that alone.
Okay. So Rare Disease Day is on Thursday. Yikes. That's coming up. How is Yara going to show up? Like, what are the actual activities? How can people get involved? How can they find you?
So our Rare Disease Week at Every Life, including Yara, ranges from, actually today it officially starts, so the 25th, Wednesday, February 28th. And that is sort of a series of events that involves like bringing advocates all together to discuss some of those key policy issues, learn about policies and also educate each other on policies, and then bringing folks directly to the Hill. That will be on Tuesday as our sort of Hill Day component. We do a documentary screening every year. We have like a congressional caucus briefing, a reception for some of our rare artists who have created really wonderful art about living with a rare disease. Where YAR comes into that is that we have some of our own YAR activities throughout. We do an in-person young adult meetup every year. That is one of my highlights. I have so many boxes of like a little YAR promotional swag that I have to somehow get from our office space to the actual building later today in my little wheelchair.
Right.
And yeah, that's always really nice. It's a way for people to network and talk with each other going into Hill meetings. Those are really some highlights. And we run one of the legislative breakout sessions every year. So we have like a whole session at like the larger legislative conference that trains advocates on policy issues that YAR members have chosen. There's two YAR members that speak every year. This year, it's one from Texas and one from Ohio. They're both wonderful. The one from Texas is actually 17. And we have started doing every year, the YAR members like vote on the policy topic that they want to focus on throughout the year. And this year, they wanted to, again, focus on what they did last year, which is ensuring access to approved treatments. So we'll be discussing a lot of those topics under that access umbrella, something like the Safe Step Act, at our breakout session. In terms of getting involved, YAR has programming year-round. People any time of the year can apply. I respond to people typically once to twice a month in terms of getting new YAR members set up. And between Rare Disease Weeks, we do a lot of stuff virtually. There's a big additional event with legislators in August that includes Zoom meetings with senators and then more in district, closer to home meetings with your House representatives. We do monthly Zoom meetings just with the YARs informally. We have some other like programming throughout the year. We do some public speaking training, some certificate program style stuff for leadership roles. Yeah. And if anyone ever has questions about like, does YAR do this? Or like, how do I get involved? Is this the right like program for me? I love chatting with people over email. I love chatting with people in general. I'm very chatty. So they're always welcome to reach out to me. You are free to like share my email with everyone.
This recording is copyright Illumina 2024. All rights reserved. Read by Dan Letchworth. Credit for all music tracks is due to Adobe Stock